You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, June 8th, 2022, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
So, guys, what are you all watching on TV recently? Anything good?
There's so much on right now. I got to say, the thing that's got me pretty much the most excited is The Offer, which is the making, behind the scenes, all the drama that went into the creation of The Godfather. I mean, if half of this stuff is true, you know, it's like kind of like a docudrama. I mean, it's definitely not a documentary, but
it's very
good. a lot of the stuff that's happening really happened. And it's just, the acting is great. The writing is fantastic. The characters just love them. Can't wait for every episode. So if you like The Godfather, definitely check out The Offer. What's it on? Is that on? That's on Netflix?
Paramount Plus, because it was produced by Paramount. That's how you remember.
Paramount Plus. Yeah, that would make sense.
I'm watching a few things on HBO and Showtime, like some comedies. I'm watching First Lady and Love That For You, and a couple like fun things. But I think the thing that I saw most recently that like had me gripped and I could not wait until it would come out each week was Under the Banner of Heaven.
Yeah, I hear really good things about that.
Ugh, it's so good. So that's based on, it's on Hulu. It's based on John Krakauer's book that came out, I think, in the early 2000s. Like, quite a famous book. Got a lot of buzz. Made the Mormon church none too pleased.
Good.
And of course, yeah, for me personally, you know, having been raised Mormon, it like hits in all the right places. And it's a very deep dive into the misogyny of the religion. It's the story basically of a detective, and he's played by Andrew Garfield. We love him, right? Do you guys love him? I love him.
Oh, yeah.
He's so good in this role, too.
Yeah.
I don't know. There's just something about, like, he plays a Mormon guy so well. But yeah, it's a story of a detective who is investigating actually a true crime, a murder that took place in Utah, more than a couple now. We're old. And it parallels him sort of learning about the foundings of the Mormon church and seeing inconsistencies and questioning the morality of it and really questioning his own faith. So it's this really cool parallel story where they've got pioneer town scenes, and then they've got modern day scenes, and then it's also a murder story. It's like all the good things.
I just binged my way through the first two seasons of The Umbrella Academy.
Oh, how was that? I've been meaning to see that.
You haven't seen it? You haven't seen it at all?
No.
Oh,
it's been on my list.
I haven't either.
Awesome. It's one of the best written shows on television.
Really?
Yeah. Is it a comic book show?
It's a comic book.
Okay. Yeah, it's based on Gerard Way's comic, right? Gerard Way was the lead singer for My Chemical Romance.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Dark Horse Comics.
Oh, man.
Well, it has good source material, but just the script writing is so tight. And it does that thing where it anticipates like questions the audience might have and it deals with them. You know what I mean? Like everything is foreshadowed or explained somehow. It ties back together, you know, without necessarily hitting you over the head with it. Just so that the characters are all wonderful. So the third season's coming out June 22nd. So I rewatched the first two seasons to remind myself of everything that happened. It's a good thing that I did because you forget so much, you know. There's so much detail in there. But just so enjoyable. If you haven't seen it, I highly recommend it.
Well, I watched you know, we're reviewing a lot of science fiction shows for Alpha Quadrant 6, and you know, I have two little kids, and it's been really hard for me between work and my kids to find time for TV. But my wife went away this week, and I had a little free time, and I was able to watch five episodes of Stranger Things season three.
Oh, man.
And I really, you know, going into it, I just felt like third season, I'm not really expecting much, you know, because you know,
fourth.
You're right. The fourth season, not expecting really anything. You know, all the actors are pretty much, you know, grown up now. They're not the same people.
And unrecognizable.
I got to tell you, like, I was shocked at how much I enjoyed it and how great they all were. Like, you know, they all connect. You know what I mean? Like, it's funny. A lot of times with children actors, like, you think, yeah, but what are they going to be like when they grow up? Because there's lots of examples of, you know, actors not being able to like do it anymore, you know, but that is not the case. And I love this show. I'm just into it. I really, really like how complex the story is. You know, it's not a light story. It's definitely like there's a lot of darkness and seriousness, and it's really good horror. You know, it's just really, really good.
Yeah, I was worried about it because, you know, the first season was magic. It was so different, you know, very, very enjoyable. The whole 80s vibe was really fun. Everything about it was really enjoyable. And then, you know, second and third seasons were good, but, you know, you can't capture that magic again. But the fourth season, I think, is better than two and three. You know, nothing's going to be as good as the first one. Sort of, yeah.
Yeah. Because I kind of gave up. I loved season one also. But season two just became, like, overly fantasy and, like, not – it didn't have enough other stuff to hook me.
Yeah.
It was a little just like too fantastic. And so I kind of gave up in season two.
Watch it at 2x speed. It'll go half the time.
I'll be chipmunks.
Yeah. No, I mean, season three was good. But four, I think, is the best season since one.
I mean, just from a pure consistency point of view, I mean, this is the fourth season. And they have maintained, they did not have a big drop off where you're like, oh, what happened, you know?
Right, they
haven't
jumped the shark.
Kara's comments notwithstanding, of course, but they kept it up. They kept it up and kept, you know, most of our interests and enjoyed them. But now four is actually even better. It's the best one since the first. And if you enjoyed the first season, definitely jump back in because it's good. Good stuff. Those Duffer brothers, I want to research them because they're kind of killing it. Good for them.
What about you, Evan?
Well, it was June 6th recently, which was, of course, you know, the anniversary of D-Day. Mm-hmm. And always around this that time of year, there's all sorts of shows on television, you know, war stories, war movies, documentaries, interviews, all having to do with, you know, a lot of World War II stuff, obviously. So something that popped up recently on my Netflix account was what? Operation Mincemeat, which is a movie I had not seen before.
Saw that too. Really good.
And the reason I bring it up because I'm familiar with the background of the story, what the operation was, a spy operation in order to throw the Germans off. But there were certain things I learned about the operation that I learned through the movie that apparently, you know, are true that I hadn't learned before in other books that I've read or shows that I've watched. So I was very satisfied. I'm always satisfied to learn more after having seen something, and I walk away with something a little extra.
Yeah.
I love watching stuff about World War II. I don't know why. And there's like so many different stories to tell. Like much happened in those 4 years. Yeah. It's just endless. But there's just something fascinating about it. I guess because, I don't know, you're dealing with like the Nazis are just great villains. You know what I mean? They're just,
they're just iconic
villains.
And there's a moral, like we all agreed morally. I mean, it took us a while to get there, sadly. But once we did, we all agreed morally. It wasn't like a divisive war the way that pretty much every war since then has been.
Other wars.
But it was militarily very complicated. Like every time I watched something about it, I learned something new. You know, it really was just fascinating from so many different levels, you know.
I don't think I could ever truly wrap my head around that entire war and all the little jigs and jags that happened. I mean, so many people were involved and so many different big things happened that I never seemed to really understand, like, the big brushstrokes of that war.
Right, and on two completely different fronts.
Mm-hmm.
Two theaters.
Two theaters with multiple countries involved in both. And, yeah, it was, you're right, very complicated.
But think about, like, there is an endless supply of drama that could be linked to that war. Like, I've seen horror movies about World War II. I've seen thrillers about World
War II.
Video games.
everything is in there. Like, it literally encompasses, like, the spectrum of a human experience. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Mm.
It is overwhelming. It's a lifetime of consumption of information that you could have. And you can walk away wanting more, wanting to learn more.
All right, well, talking about learning more, we're going to move on with our news items. We got some interesting stuff lined up for you today. Kara, you're going to start us off with a discussion of infantile amnesia. Why don't we remember things from when we were like 1 year old?
Yeah. And I think this is a fun story that I came across that was published in The Conversation by a psychologist at Rutgers named Vanessa Lobue, or Lobue, I'm not sure. Yeah, this isn't really based on any new big discovery, no big new publication, but sort of a compilation of what she knows, because this is her, I guess, area of expertise, and she teaches child development. And so let's pose that question to you all, because it's As you might guess, a multifaceted answer. Why do you think we don't remember things from when we're babies?
I would say that parts of our brain aren't developed enough.
Yeah, the recorder part of our brain isn't fully functioning at that point.
Right, we're missing some hardware. Yeah, okay.
Something about the hippocampus.
Something about the hippocampus.
I don't think it's anything like that because we learn, right? You know, when you're 1 or 2 years old, you're not like you haven't learned stuff. It's really...
But that's different types of memory, though.
I always thought it was mainly due to the fact that we don't have a language. Mm-hmm. We don't have something to anchor those memories. But it could just be also that just, you know, it is a brain development thing.
Mm-hmm. And so, you know, researchers think it's kind of all of the above and then some additional stuff that we'll talk about. But I think you brought up something important, Steve, that Bob, you questioned, which I think is also an important conversation to be had here, which is what's the difference between learning and memory? Mm-hmm. You know, I think in some ways, I come from psychology, but by way of neuroscience. And it's also, it's always been really interesting to me having one foot in kind of each pool to see how neurobiologists and how psychologists describe similar concepts using their own sort of constructions. And so very often you'll see that in cognitive psychology, there are descriptions of things like memory that are somewhat different than the way neuroscientists might describe memory. For me personally, learning and memory are sort of flavors of the same thing. And I'm curious, Steve, is it safe for me to assume that based on your statement that you kind of see them the same way? They're sort of interpretations and different utilizations of very similar neural processes.
But we know that there are different kinds of memory, right?
Mm-hmm.
There is operational memory, learning stuff. And then there's autobiographical memory, learning, remembering your life. And it's what infants lack is the autobiographical memory. But they're still learning about the world. They're learning language. They're learning to recognize people, et cetera.
Absolutely. So when we think about memory, we can kind of divide it into two main types. We often divide it into long-term and short-term or working memory. Long-term memory is all the stuff that actually is retrievable, right? And short-term memory, working memory is sort of... it's the very short time that you're keeping something in mind before encoding it or before transferring it into this long-term memory.
Memory is like 2 to 3 days before it gets consolidated into long-term memory. Whereas
working memory is like at the time.
It's only like a couple of minutes, and it's holding bits of information that you can manipulate. So when you're doing math in your head, you're using your working memory. It's like your RAM, right? We're a short-term...
Actually, wait. I think we're mixing. Those are backward. Short-term memory shorter than working memory.
Well, but the working memory is the memory that you can manipulate.
Yeah, it is. It is, but it lasts longer. You're right. Working memory is by definition, I mean, it's in the name. It's your working memory. It's the memory that you manipulate. It's the memory that you're utilizing. It's sort of related to attention and whether or not it becomes encoded into long-term memory. But short-term memory, I think, is much more like just basic attention. You don't hold on to it. Short-term memory is seconds. It's like active attention, maybe 20, 30 seconds or less. Then working memory is the memory that we're implicitly deciding to utilize or not. We're comparing it to other things. We're matching it up with our experience, and we're starting to figure out whether or not it gets encoded. If it doesn't get encoded, then it's lost. Long-term memory is anything that's encoded, but I think there are briefer engagements with long-term memory. You can encode something and then never access it again.
Right, yeah.
Or you can encode something and then rehearse it all the time and access it a lot, which, as we know, we've talked about this a lot on the show. We're not tape recorders. Every time we rehearse something, it changes a little bit. But yeah, so short-term, the shortest, then working, then long-term. But regardless, Bob, you're right. When we talk about these big, those are the big distinctions. But what we're really talking about today is types of long-term memory. And as you mentioned, Steve, there's autobiographical memory. There's also declarative memory. Sometimes we call it explicit memory. And then there's implicit memory. So think about it this way. Autobiographical is parts of our life. It's our relationship to our memory. It's sort of our narrative, our chronology. Explicit memory is like you know, in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. It's like things that are conscious that you can declare, that you can say out loud. And then implicit memory is think about things like rote repetition. It's sort of like remembering how to get somewhere.
Unconscious.
Like a procedural memory, things like that. There's so many different labels for this stuff. But yeah, sort of implicit, unconscious. And very often you would relate that to sort of rote learning.
So I think for this task, for this specific topic, mm-hmm. we're definitely going to we would need to focus on explicit memory, which is conscious, not implicit. This is we're talking about conscious explicit memories from when we were really young.
Well, and really, we're talking about autobiographical memory, like Steve said.
But I think that's a labeling thing because my understanding when you talk about long term, it's explicit and implicit,
and then you said. Yeah.
But then explicit is something that I think we need to go down that road. And there you see things like declarative memory, which is facts and events, and then they further break that down into these are the two that I think are the crux here: episodic, which is events and experiences, semantic. Which is what we forget. And then there's semantic, which is facts and concepts. So the facts and concepts are retained, it seems, from that young age, but the episodic events and experiences, that's what's really that we don't remember.
And I think
at least according to, you know, this, you know, common labeling system, episodic and semantic.
And some people might argue that the episodic is only even that it's not explicit, that really you're not retaining much of that, but you're really only retaining implicit memory. Because of the age and because of some of the factors that we've described. So, you know, there are a million different ways to, we talk about this concept, actually. This is a larger conversation, but about taxonomy, about categorization. And there's, again, I always recommend this book when we get onto this topic by Lulu Miller called Why Fish Don't Exist. And it's really about this concept. How do we label things? How do we make meaningful distinctions? And, you know, sometimes they're meaningful depending on the field you're in, depending on the specific topic you're talking about. But let's use a term which is not a perfect term. It has fuzzy boundaries. But this term autobiographical memory, this sort of self-referential memory, this memory for our own lives, because that seems to be what a lot of researchers do sort of home in on when we talk about infantile amnesia. Infantile, I don't know why that word makes me laugh.
It describes an adult acting.
Oh my god!
Infantile dysfunction. That's like I don't know why that's what I hear. Anyway,
I will always link those words.
Sorry. But basically, if we were to say, you know, tell me a memory from when you were young, very often people recall memories from like starting around 3, 4, 5 years old. Very rarely. If at all.
And who knows how accurate it is.
Yeah, and who knows how accurate, right?
But it could be totally
a memory of a memory.
Yeah, but very rarely do we hear much about something that happened when somebody was one. And, you know, researchers think that we may not be able to develop these autobiographical memories at that age, but it is very true, as Steve mentioned, as we were just grappling with Bob, that of course we're learning when we're young, and learning requires that you hold things in your memory. So there are super early examples of experiments that show, you know, kind of without a shadow of a doubt, that like infants know their own mother's face. They can recall it. They can distinguish it mm-hmm. from strangers. The longer that they're exposed to faces, the more they can recognize them. And we have different ways of measuring this that aren't always perfect. There are gaze tests that are often used with infants. Some people argue that these aren't appropriate because kids will look at things for longer periods for lots of reasons. Sometimes it's about novelty. Sometimes it's about memory. But there is a study that was detailed in this article that I'm referencing that – well, not a study, a series of studies that were done by Carolyn Rovey Collier. And she was a Rutgers psychologist who unfortunately died in, I think, 2014. But she was kind of like really instrumental in helping us understand learning and memory in infants. And she did these really cool experiments where she would put babies in cribs and they would watch a mobile and they would see how often – so babies would watch a mobile because it was interesting to them, and babies also kick because that's what babies do. They kick their legs. And then what they did after they got baseline measurements of gaze and of kick activity is they tied a string between the baby's leg and the mobile. This is very low tech and I love it. And very quickly the baby learns, hey, if I kick, the mobile moves. That's fun. And so babies often will kick significantly more often once they learn that. And so there is a certain amount of learning that you're seeing there because they change their behavior based on this feedback. And they did, they adapt it for older children as well. But what we don't see, for example, and this is, I think, an important aspect of autobiographical memory, is we don't see children passing the mirror test when they're really, really young. Takes them a while. Yeah, I think not until they're about 18 to 24 months will babies, when they're looking at a mirror, notice a mark on their face, recognize that it is their own face, and start to try and wipe it off. Prior to that, they don't seem to recognize themselves in the mirror. They see a baby, like their eyes are fine, but they don't have that concept of self. And so then that raises the question, can we form memories about ourselves if we don't even have a concept of what selfness is? Hmm. That's, I think it's somewhat philosophical. I don't know if we could ever answer it neurologically, but I think it's an important question. And then, of course, we add to that the fact that until like later in the second year, we don't develop language. And of course, how much is memory tied to language? As you mentioned, Steve, we've often talked about like embodied cognition, that language helps us label things and we label them in a way that they relate to our person. If you think about the way that the words that we often use prepositionally speaking, they're very much geometrically relational. Above, beneath, under, within. They have to do with this concept of space and of where we fit within space. And as we develop language, we're also developing, or actually a little bit later, first we're developing this kind of sense of self, then we're developing language. And then, as you mentioned, I think Bob mentioned it and Jay did as well, the hippocampus simply isn't developed in infancy. So there probably are some purely neurological limitations as well. And really, what are we talking about? We may be talking about emergent properties here. All of these things aren't, it's not sense of self and language and hippocampal development and frontal lobe development. I mean, these things all play off of each other and in some ways are the same thing. They rely on one another and they're just different ways that we conceptualize them. So it does seem to be that there are some fundamental limitations for developing autobiographical memory, but I'm catching myself even in that statement. Maybe we do develop them. Maybe we do encode them. We just can't retrieve them. And there's really no way to know.
They're there waiting for us to pull
them. Like, Kara, are you saying that these things are encoded in like a baby brain format that we no longer can access?
Could be. I mean, there's really no, I mean, I don't know. That's a gross hypothesis, but there's really no way to know. I mean, the thing about memory is that we don't know it's there unless we can evoke it. And so, you know, we are capable of retrieving through will. There are also examples where we can prime memories. And then there are examples, there's some really cool examples. And Steve, you've probably been just as fascinated by these studies as I have through the years, where during deep brain stimulation surgeries, memories are evoked simply through neurology. Like they're actually evoked. And that's kind of cool too, because very often this is more of a cognitive process than a physiological process. But really it's hard to know because memory isn't a memory, or it's not a memory that we can discuss unless we have both aspects. First, we have to encode it, but then we have to access it. We have to retrieve it.
Is there, what would be the advantage for a person, an infant, to be able to store the memory in such a way that it could be retrieved later in life? Is there an advantage, or is the brain wasting resources at that point?
I think in some ways that it might be a bias to think of it that way, similar to like when we think about evolution as being advantageous, like this is advantageous over that, like that there's a goal at the end of it. I mean, it just is a process that we develop with life. That's like kind of like saying, what's the advantage of having memory as an adult? I mean, there's a million reasons for it, and it has to develop somehow and at some point in time. So I think, I don't know. I mean, correct me if you disagree with this, but I think that this is just a function of, we can point to the sort of developmental era at which this becomes codified, at which this becomes functional. But I don't think there's a why. There's a how. But I don't know if there's a why.
I mean, how busy is the six-month-old brain sort of just doing what it
needs
to do?
Bananas busy. baby brains are so taxed, right? But they also sleep so, so much because of that. But if you think about the amount of metabolism that's necessary for just starting to develop associations, starting to learn. Pruning, so much of this neurological pruning is happening at this point, right? Neurons are firing, we're developing these Hebbian synapses, so neurons are firing together and associations are being made, and we're actually laying down architecture and sort of losing other associations. There's a lot going on in those first few months, a lot. So yeah, I mean, that is an interesting question, Evan. And now I guess I'm kind of seeing it for what I'm. Correct me if I'm wrong. For what I'm thinking, maybe you were pointing to, which is from a purely efficiency, like a metabolic efficiency perspective.
Right.
Why waste
That's
resources?
Right.
Gotcha.
Right. Yeah. If it's running full capacity, doing what it needs to do.
Right. And
why spend time doing something else that is what. Superfluous, right?
And it could be as simple as, again, not a why, but a how. Not that there's any sort of choice in this, but that it just isn't as important. It's taking a backseat to some of the more important processes, and eventually it becomes more important. But yeah, it's
low priority.
Yeah. But it's a fascinating, I think we all sort of take for granted that babies don't remember stuff. You know, it's like, I won't remember it anyway. But they are actively learning all the time. And we know little kids are like total sponges the older they get, too. But, you know, when they are infants, 1 and 2 years old, they are, or 1 and 1.5 years old, they're actively learning all the time. But that switch over to being able to tell stories about themselves, understand who they are, how they fit into the world, develop language, all of these things do seem to have a role. And it's clearly, like most of the things we talk about on SGU, it's complicated.
It's very complicated.
Tara, what's your youngest autobiographical memory?
I can tell you that I have what I like to think of as a flashbulb memory, my first sort of evocative emotional memory. And I have no idea how old I was. I was maybe 3 or 4. But we used to go to, what was it called? Oh, it was a burger place, Fuddruckers in Texas.
Yeah. And we had one in Connecticut.
Yeah. The reason I think we went there is because kids under a certain age ate free with every adult. And I grew up, you know, when I was really, really young, it's still my mom and my dad, and it was just me and my sister. So 2 free kid meals. But so we went there, and I don't remember being there. I don't remember anything except having the balloon. They used to give you a balloon when you were a kid and you would eat there. And I came home and I had the balloon wrapped around my wrist and I was so excited. And we had these prickly bushes in front of our house and the balloon popped on the prickly bush. And it's so funny, but it's like my first feeling, like memory feeling of loss. And it actually evokes like a lot of sadness in me when I think about it.
Oh, gosh.
Isn't that funny? Like it's fundamental to later, much more complicated and sophisticated experience of loss. But I felt inconsolable. I had lost this thing that I loved, you know, as insofar as a 2 or 3 year old or 4 year old can form those kinds of attachments. And I remember that feeling. What about you, Steve? What's your first?
Yeah, I was 3. I have a couple of again, those flash memories from being in daycare. One, probably the strongest, is I was like in the kitchen area. I remember I was standing up, but the table was over my head, right? So the room is huge in my memory, right? And I guess we were getting soup. It was beef and barley soup. I remember that because I remember the smell, and the smell always brings back that memory.
Oh, right.
Interesting.
I
Very
love smell associations with
memory. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, Jay, this is an interesting question that I think many people may have asked themselves at one point or another. How come there aren't any giant animals anymore like the dinosaurs?
Yeah, why were they able to grow so big, and then what happened to the big animals?
So big.
So you guys have all been to a museum of natural history. I mean, I'm sure most of the people listening to this podcast, you've seen the bones, right? They're huge.
Look at the bones.
You
know,
you stand at the base of some dinosaur displays, and you know the thing is what, 30, 40 feet tall. You know, there's dinosaurs that were just absolutely strikingly enormous. And as a side note, there was a lot of other animals that were huge too, which you might not be aware of. There were giant ground sloths. There was a giant penguin that was 6.5 feet or 2 meters tall, and it weighed 250 pounds or 115 kilograms. That's a lot bigger than me. Dragonflies that used to have a wingspan of about 12 inches or 30 centimeters. And there is a 4.5 times the size. I'm sorry. And that is 4.5 times the size of a modern dragonfly. That's big. And of course, a creature that can only be described as a monster, the Megalodon. It's a monster. It makes Jaws look like a joke, and these things were real.
I know, I saw that.
And everybody seems to be okay with this. I just don't get it. Anyway. So dinosaurs existed during the Triassic, Jurassic, and Cretaceous periods. And one of those words had a movie named after it. And at the time, the climate was a lot warmer. As you guys know, CO2 levels were over 4 times higher than they are today. So dinosaur remains have been found as far back. I mean, this goes way back to the 6th century BC. When paleontology took off in the 19th century, since then, scientists have been trying to explain, you know, why are these animals so big? Why were these freaking dinosaurs so big? You know, what was it about the distant past that was different, and, you know, why aren't they anything like that here today? And the answer is, it's complicated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Got me again.
There are potentially a lot of answers. It's not one thing. It's not like, oh, because of blah, they were big. It's like because of tons of things. First off, let's talk about teeth. So let's say you're a baby dinosaur who is one day going to be huge. You're not huge yet, but you're just a little tiny little critter there. Well, you'd start out eating small prey, right? If you were that kind of animal that eats other animals. And you were lucky because you had these tiny little sharp teeth. They're perfect for killing small prey. And as you lost your teeth, new ones would replace them, like a shark, right? Now you're getting bigger, and so do your teeth. Your teeth are getting bigger as well. And on top of that, your teeth not only got bigger, but they would change in type to suit the new prey that you were hunting. Not that.
Whoa.
Like it was already programmed, of course, into them. Like, you know, at this age, the teeth are like this, and at this age, they're bigger and they're like this. So they evolved to have different sets of teeth for different types of prey at different times in their lifespan. Whoa. That's freaking amazing. Let's go to bones. Dinosaurs could be as big as, you know, 100 feet long and weighing upwards of 45 tons. They were big, so their bones had to be strong, but their bones had to also be light. So some dinosaur bones had channels for air sacs that came from their circulatory system. This is like modern birds. They have extensive air sac systems. And this gives the bones the ability to be extraordinarily light, but gives them strength as well. And this means that since dinosaurs had a lighter skeleton, they needed less muscle to power their movement. And this in turn reduced the amount of body heat that they produced. And this is the case. This is not the case with modern mammals, right? Land mammals can only get to the size of roughly about an elephant, maybe a little bit bigger, but that's the limit. And warm-blooded animals require a lot more food. As you know, if anyone has had a meal with me recently, we require lots and lots of food. So a huge cold-blooded dinosaur would eat 1/5 the food of a modern elephant. Think about that.
Yeah, but Jay, I was reading that article and it struck me that it was a little out of sync with the news item from last week because the largest dinosaurs, the sauropods, were warm-blooded.
We talked about it. I know. I mean, these are generalities. You know what I mean?
You know, this article was sort of like didn't update itself to that information yet. So they were partly speculating. Maybe they were only on the low end of the warm-blooded size. Like, no, actually, they were fully warm-blooded. So that wasn't really a factor in the size. You know, remember the whole gigantothermic thing was just not true. Yeah. Yeah, I know. But the point is, they were saying in the reference article about dinosaur size that the big dinosaurs were not that warm blooded, and that helped them get that big. But actually, the biggest dinosaurs were fully warm blooded, so that is really just not a factor.
Right. So there's a consensus now.
Well, then this is just a news item from last week.
Yeah.
Right?
It's still percolating through.
Yeah. Right. It just hadn't it wasn't updated yet. So I think that one piece that doesn't jibe with the most recent evidence on dinosaur warm-bloodedness.
Hmm. Okay. Well, if they were cold-blooded, they would have eaten 1/5 the food of a modern elephant. But there is more recent information. The environment. So let's talk about what was their environment like. So another factor that allowed dinosaurs to be as big had to be their environment. There had to be plenty of oxygen and food to cover their needs. Their habitat in particular, it had to be just right you know, it had to be the perfect mix of things in order for these giant creatures to come into being. They required ecologies that were at the beginning of when the dinosaurs first started to appear. The environment was already there, like it was waiting for them. So since CO2 levels were higher, like I said, this gave plant life this huge boost of making, you know, it was a great time to be an herbivore. Let me put it to you that way. Plants of all varieties were everywhere. And we're talking about like everywhere, like North and South Pole as well. Like wherever there was land and dinosaurs were living, there was plants and there was tons of herbivores, you know, eating through these plants, and they had a seemingly endless supply of food. Now, as we know, more carbon dioxide is directly correlated with increased global temperature, right? So I've read that the daytime average temperature was 90 to 100 degrees Fahrenheit or 32 to 38 degrees Celsius.
That's average.
Yeah. Yep.
That's nuts.
No. That's fucking hot. That's really
nuts. Balmy. That is balmy. That is humid.
So more oxygen also likely played a big role in allowing for giant insects as well. So let's
were critical. I think that, you know, you could say that the oxygen was probably overwhelmingly critical. It wasn't, you know, more so perhaps than dinosaurs, you know, this increase in oxygen. How high did it get? Was it like
4%?
Yeah, it was so compared to that was like the main reason. Yeah. The main reason they otherwise, you know, insects just couldn't get that big without that much oxygen.
Do you know why that is? You know why that's so important for insects? Because they don't really have circulatory systems. The oxygen diffuses through their tissue, so there's just a limit on the distance that the oxygen can diffuse. So you increase the oxygen tension even by a few percent.
More diffusion over
more diffusion, they can get bigger. They can have basically they can have parts of their body farther from their skin, you know.
Huh.
All right, now let's click over to size. So once large bodies did evolve, which took a very long time, it gave those dinosaurs more protection from predators, right? If the dinosaurs grew big enough, like for instance, the hadrosaur, even a pack of tyrannosaurs couldn't bring it down because it was just too big. Now let's talk about skull size. Some dinosaurs have had large head ornamentation, right? You've seen tons of pictures of really weird shaped dinosaur heads and all this stuff. So they use these heads to fight. They were very, very, very likely to attract mates. And the sheer size of the head itself could have given dinosaurs more protection, right? You know, think about the skull is bigger, thicker, heavier. One study showed that dinosaurs with large head features evolved to larger sizes 20 times faster than those without. So there was a huge boon to having a large, bulky head, right? And not so much today, but back then it was really in. Now, time was another factor. Another thing that we have to consider here is that it took the dinosaurs an incredible amount of time to evolve to be this huge, right? There were so many things that had to change in order for the dinosaurs to get up to these sizes. During that time, the habitats had to be very stable and consistent, which it happened to be, right? So that's why they were able to live for so long and be so prosperous. Now, as the environment slowly changed again, right? So millions of years are going by and the environment is now getting cooler, it's possible, right? Like that an asteroid impact hit. And if that did, it probably very quickly killed off all the largest creatures out there because their food supply and environment and habitats were significantly disrupted. Now we have this big dying off of these large creatures. You know, so now it comes in the smaller animals. And smaller animals were also during these times learning to have their social structures were starting to develop, and they were learning to hunt in packs, which enabled them to take down larger prey. That was another thing that even reduced the size of the remaining largest animals, however large they were, all the way up into modern times where, you know, we killed off the closest thing to an elephant at the time because we were hunting them into extinction. So, you know, like I said, tons of factors all mishmashed together, you know, there's probably dozens and dozens more that we don't even know about, of course, because we don't have live specimens and we don't really know what the environment was exactly like. You know, a lot of things are speculation, but these are very likely things that had an impact on why they could get that big. And then, you know, the dying off and the larger animals kept getting killed and taken down and the environment kept changing until we get to the point where, you know, we the largest creatures today live in the ocean. You know, we have whales as the largest creatures, and they're supported by their body weight is supported by water. Like, of course, they couldn't live on land, So land animals really have come way down in size to where we're looking at modern day elephants.
And average sizes, I mean, they increased for a while among the mammals. You know, there was the age of gigantism, not anything close to dinosaur size, but everything was big, mainly because of competition. Like, so the, you know, prey gets bigger, so they're protected from predators. So predators get bigger to eat the bigger prey. So there's like, you know, an arms race of size. Yeah. So, but then that takes time to play out. But then the trend reversed, which, you know, a lot of researchers attribute to human hunting. We basically kill off the biggest animals because they're the most meat. And so the average size of mammals has been decreasing over the last, you know, 20, 30,000 years. One argument I didn't buy was there just hasn't been enough evolutionary time to get that big, because the biggest creatures to ever live are alive now, the whales, as you said. They evolved, you know, in the last 60 million years. There has been enough time for creatures to get bigger than the biggest dinosaurs. I think it's just that mammals can't get that big, right? Reptiles are just different. Reptiles continue to grow throughout their life, unlike mammals. Again, they have the lighter bone structure. They, you know, replace their teeth more often so they could adapt to larger stages, you know, in feeding strategies, etc. So there's like a lot of features that reptiles have that mammals simply don't have.
Yeah, plus how fair is it to compare, you know, land-dwelling reptiles to, you know, sea-going mammals? Mm-hmm. In terms of size, it might be just easier to grow big in the water because you've got all the water supporting you, so it's not as difficult.
Yeah, you don't need to evolve as many adaptations.
Yeah.
That's true.
Just stay streamlined.
Yeah. But it tells you how complicated a question it is. You know, there's so many factors involved.
Huge.
All right, guys, I'm going to tell you about something else that is also complicated, not as complicated as the previous two topics. And I'm going to take a page from Kara and start by asking you a question. The question is, what do you think causes traffic jams? What's the most common causes of traffic congestion, like traffic congestion.
Cars. Idiocy.
I think it's a lack of attention.
With wheels.
Like rubbernecking.
It's inefficiency in driving.
Any vehicle on the highway.
Like, you know, like
Evan,
not.
Evan is correct. It is cars, vehicles. Is
but isn't it the people's behavior behind the wheel of the vehicle?
It's also that.
Yes. So
I know it's not the lanes.
Vehicle didn't
I know
get
it's
there
not
by
lack
itself.
Of lanes.
Well, it could be lack of lanes. It's not a simple linear relationship, and you can inadvertently worsen traffic by increasing lanes, by altering the flow of traffic, by altering behavior. So you guys are hitting on the big things, but let me clarify it all a little bit for you. So there are hard causes and soft causes, right? So there is the like infrastructure material causes. This is just how many cars and vehicles are there on the roads? How many lanes are there? What's the carrying capacity of those roads? And if the number of vehicles begins to exceed the carrying capacity, that tremendously reduces the average speed at which vehicles can go. Right. So that is a major cause of traffic. So bottlenecks because of infrastructure account for about 40% of traffic congestion. And construction, ironically, you know, attempts at improving that infrastructure causes 10%. Right. So 10% of traffic is just caused by they're fixing the roads at that time. Right. Mm-hmm. 40% are just congestion. There's too many cars for the roadway itself. So that's about half. Right. But half of congestion is caused by those sort of infrastructure hard causes. Then there are, or those are called, are long-term or recurring causes of traffic because they're there all the time. Then there are temporary causes. Oh. These are things that are due to temporary
collisions.
Conditions. So weather is a big one. The environment just is a more general category. That's about 15%. Bad weather causes about 15% of traffic, according to the Department of Transportation. And then there is, you know, accidents, breakdowns, you know, mechanical failure, things like that. That causes another chunk. And then finally we come to human causes, just driving behavior. This primarily results from what's called a phantom traffic jam. Have you guys ever heard that term, a phantom traffic jam?
No.
So that's entirely caused by driving behavior. It's called a phantom traffic jam because there's no apparent physical cause. Has that ever happened to you where traffic just slows down?
Oh, it happens all the time. That's what I was referring to when you said, what is the
I always think it's like an echo of something that happened prior to that, and it's catching up to the point of going back to some state of normalcy.
Oh, see, I always just think it's because people suck at merging and people suck at paying attention to the car in front of them and they don't pace them. I also think brake lights on the freeway are the bane of my existence. Don't brake.
It's a trigger.
Unless you have to. Yeah, because one person brakes, everybody behind them brakes, and often for no reason.
True. Yeah, it's domino effect.
We take our cues from the cars in front of us.
That's exactly what a phantom traffic jam is. So if someone slows down for whatever reason, right?
Yeah, rubbernecking.
It could be rubbernecking. It could be they're coming to a steep turn and they want to really slow down. Or they weren't paying attention. They got a little too close to the car in front of them or whatever.
Or just they're bad drivers and they don't understand how to slow down without braking.
Right. Exactly. So they when one car slows down, the car behind it needs to slow down a little more. And then the car behind that slows down a little more. And that keeps propagating back until you come to a stop. And there's no reason, like there's nothing in the road that would explain it. So it just propagates through until traffic comes to a halt. So that's a phantom traffic jam. The other driving behavior thing, which is actually external, is traffic lights, right? Because the traffic lights are programmed in order to manage the flow of traffic. So let's talk about these two soft causes, phantom traffic jams and traffic lights, because those are the most immediately modifiable kind of variables. Obviously, it takes time to build roads, a lot of investment. The construction itself slows down traffic, so that takes a long time to fix. You can't do much about the weather. You could try to minimize accidents, but it's going to happen, et cetera, et cetera. But these two are just like the two variables that should be the most modifiable. And what's triggering this whole discussion is a study looking at artificial intelligence in order to be better at managing the traffic lights. Well, let's talk about that first. Today, in the developed parts of the world, traffic lights can be controlled by computer, and they follow an algorithm designed to optimize flow. But they're suboptimal. They're not necessarily fully optimized because it's a very complicated problem, right? It's not like there's a simple mathematical equation that you can apply to a complicated, intersection or set of traffic. And it also has to be somewhat dynamic, right? I mean, it's moment to moment changing to the flow of traffic through an intersection, for example. A dynamic, intelligent control that requires, artificial intelligence. So some researchers did. They were really basically trying to answer a very specific question. Is they developed a deep learning reward-based algorithm, right, called deep reinforcement learning. Have you heard of that one, Bob? Have you heard of that one, Bob?
Yeah. Yep.
DRL, deep reinforcement learning. So basically, the AI gets a virtual reward whenever a car goes through an intersection.
Wouldn't there have to be like programming in place to make that reward actually meaningful to an AI?
Well, yeah, of course. That's assumed. Yeah. Reward is in air quotes that you can't see because it's positive reinforcement for the AI. Like in some software programming mechanism, this reinforces the AI's behavior. I want to do that. I want to get more of those, right? So, and then also they get negative reward for unwanted outcomes like traffic slowing down. So that's how the deep reinforcement learning is programmed. And in this model, they used video cameras to monitor the intersection. The other potential method, and there are lots of places that have this, is you can put, there's like sensors in the road that will detect every time a car goes past. So you could literally count the number of cars go past that way. But in the model they used, they just used video because it's more common. They trained the AI on a simulation, right? So not in a real world scenario. And their primary question was, if we train our AI purely on a simulation, will that work? Will that improve their ability to then manage an actual real world intersection?
That's a question.
Yeah, that because if it can, that's huge. Because it's a lot easier to train software, right, on a simulation.
Sure.
You don't have to train it in a real-world scenario. And the bottom line is they found that it worked really well. They were able to train their software on a simulation and then apply it to the real world, and it worked. So that's great. So now they just need to, you know, implement it more in real-world situations and see how it does. But it was able to significantly increase the throughput, you know, through these intersections by using this, again, this deep learning algorithm that helped them optimize the timing of the traffic lights. So that could have a significant decrease in traffic jams and traffic congestion, you know, just by improving the control of traffic lights. The interesting thing was the other end was the phantom traffic jam. So how could we reduce phantom traffic jams? Kara, you're kind of hitting on it, but mm-hmm. if there was one method that worked, turned out to be the most effective in terms of reducing phantom traffic jams, and they were able to reduce it by 50%, reduce phantom traffic jams by 50% by doing one thing.
Carpooling?
No. Although carpooling is good for overall traffic congestion. Yeah.
I guess I feel like this is like an open menu. Like, I feel like I need some constraints to be able to guess the answer to this.
The answer relates to what the primary cause of phantom traffic jams is. And again, you didn't say the magic word. It is driving behavior, people not knowing how to drive, whatever. But the number one cause is tailgating.
Yes. Because if you weren't tailgating, when they tap their brake, you wouldn't have to tap your brake.
You wouldn't have to tap your brake. Exactly. Yeah. Tailgating dramatically increases phantom traffic jams.
Ah.
So reducing tailgating dramatically reduces phantom traffic jams. But what's the driver? You know, what is the actual best method to use? And it's something that the researchers are calling bilateral control. And so it's not just managing the distance between you and the car in front of you. It's also between you and the car behind you. And the mm-hmm. optimal behavior seems to be to evenly space yourself out between the car in front of you and the car behind you. And when you do this,
that's constantly changing.
Reduces phantom traffic jams by the largest amount.
But we really have little control over how close the car behind us gets to us.
That's a three-car equation.
I know. Everyone needs to be doing this. Right? Yeah. Everyone needs to be doing this. It's not
well,
just
and tech right. can really improve this. Like, my right. car has a follow-behind signal.
Exactly.
So when it recognizes there's a car in front of me, it's a little green car. When I'm getting too close to it, it's a red car. And then if I get too close to it, it goes beep, beep, beep.
And this is where AI comes in.
Mine will actually engage my brake if it senses for some reason I'm accelerating and the car ahead of me is not moving at a fast enough speed.
I can tell.
It'll initiate my brake.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mine too. It's cool.
Exactly. So obviously driver education can help, but that would have to be pretty thorough. And some people are calling for that. And in fact, people who do get more extensive driving coaching do better. The outcomes are better. But in any case, something that would be very easy to implement would be simply a software update for any cars with driver assist, right? So what you guys are talking about is driver assist. It's not a total self-driving car, but it tells you you're getting a little bit too close to the car in front of you. Now, if we update the algorithm of the driver assist to do bilateral control where it's managing, it's trying to position you halfway between the car in front of you and the car behind you. And especially if a lot of the cars on the road have that could significantly reduce phantom traffic jams.
I still feel like psychologically, all you need, and tell me if I'm wrong here mathematically, but all you need is the forward assist if most cars have it, because that automatically spaces. And psychologically, I think it would with drivers' heads if their car was constantly telling them that a car was getting too close on the back end.
And to speed up.
Yeah, I think it would make them speed up and do bad things and get anxious when they drive.
Yeah, at this point we're talking about like in a computer simulation.
Yeah.
Mathematically, that's what works. Now you have to factor human behavior into the equation. So you may be right sometimes, and we encounter this in medicine all the time. There's something called an intention to treat analysis where you're looking at not just what would be the optimal outcome, but what's the best outcome you're going to get out of people, you know?
Yeah.
And when you implement it in the real world. So what you're talking about is an intention to treat kind of approach to driving control. Sometimes it's better to give people a suboptimal but simple rule they can follow than an optimal complex rule that they can't follow. But this would need to be tested in the real world. But again, if cars are doing it because of just on their own, if like just automated driving is doing it, self-driving cars are doing it, we don't, who cares, right? We can have it be as complicated as possible. So of course, in 10, 20 years or whatever, when we get to that point where we're, where most cars on the road are self-driving, it's all going to be AI controlled. And but the good news is that this should significantly reduce traffic, because in addition to managing things like avoiding traffic jams, for example, like not tailgating and spacing themselves out optimally and timing with the lights optimally, et cetera, it could also route your pathway to adjust the overall flow of traffic to avoid congestion. And this is, again, this actually gets back to Bob's point, where people are attracted to the more lanes, which actually can cause more congestions. It actually shifts traffic in a negative way sometimes. You have to actually, it doesn't always, Bob, it's not every single time. Sometimes adding lanes does help, but you have to simulate it and figure out if adding a lane will be a positive or a negative thing. Because if you're not careful, you could actually have the opposite effect by negatively affecting traffic patterns. But if we have networked self-driving cars, algorithms will run it all. We don't need to worry about it. The human behavior, like the flocking behavior thing where people are like, why do people tailgate? You know, it's interesting. When you're in traffic, you're like anxious and you're right up on the guy in front of you. Why does everybody do that? It makes absolutely no sense. It doesn't get you there any sooner. It actually just makes traffic flow slower. If everybody just relaxed and backed off a little bit, tried to keep a steady pace rather than constantly accelerating to get to the car in front of them, traffic would move more smoothly, but most people behave in a counterproductive way.
Yeah. There's also this interesting phenomenon, Steve, where it's maybe an unintended, or I'm hoping it's an unintended but positive outcome of a future where we have networked self-driving cars, is I think there will simply be fewer cars on the road. Because I think fewer people will own cars. It will be much easier to have more of a car hailing economy when all the cars are self-driving anyway. And there's a system by which they just pick you up and take you where you need to go.
But we talked, Kara, about this. That
doesn't work everywhere.
Cars as a service may actually increase the cars on the road, because now you have self-driving cars with no passengers going to the next person who's summoning them. But
I wonder if it's not a net.
It may not be a net. It may not be a net negative. But that's another variable, and it depends on how it all plays out. Again, it gets complicated.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
All right, Bob, you recently took a trip, and you wanted to talk about something that you ran into that you thought was cool.
Oh my gosh, is it okay? Thanks, Kara.
It's very okay. This happened in West Virginia recently. Liz set up a tour for at the Green Bank Observatory.
Cool.
And I had heard about the Green Bank Observatory for sure, but the details were kind of fuzzy since I'm reading about observatories all the time. And it's not so fuzzy anymore. I have to say, the history of this place and the current work, plus the sheer Brobdingnagian awesomeness of my first encounter with a huge radio telescope, made me decide to do a deeper dive and talk about the mighty Green Bank Observatory. What a fun tour. So it wasn't always called the Green Bank Observatory. For years, it was the National Radio Astronomy Observatory, built in 1957 by the National Science Foundation. It was the United States' first national astronomy observatory, and also the first national laboratory open to all scientists from all around the world. At that time, in the late 50s, they had a head honcho meeting in D.C., and they're like, we need a national astronomy observatory and radio astronomy, because we were way behind, and we needed to really do some catch-up, and we certainly did. So then once Green Bank was there for a while, then other observatories also were created as part of this network. Then it was basically referred to as the National Radio Astronomy Observatory, Green Bank. And now, since I think 2016, it's more independent. It's no longer officially affiliated with the government, and it's simply called Green Bank Observatory. It's still doing amazing stuff. So now, driving to the observatory, and it was still quite far away, and I first noticed this amazingly huge annoyance that overcame me as I had no damn cell service, not one damn bar, nothing. There was nothing on my phone. Super annoying, as I'm sure many of you can relate. Turns out there was a very interesting reason why that's so, and it's called the United States National Radio Quiet Zone. That's a 13,000 square mile area.
I've never heard of the Quiet Zone.
Yeah, the Quiet Zone, National Radio Quiet Zone, 13,000 square miles, and I was right in the middle of it.
Did you put your phone on airplane mode?
No. No need to. It wasn't getting anything.
No, but that's why you should do that, because otherwise your phone is going to constantly be pinging to try to find a signal, and it'll run the battery down.
Oh.
Yeah, my phone was plugged in. The battery wasn't going anywhere. But it gets even more interesting, because I was right in the middle of this, and radio transmissions are restricted by federal regulations.
Yeah.
This is like it's a really interesting area. And because they did this, why they do this? Because radio telescopes are, bottom line, just so super sensitive that they are susceptible to any weak radio interference that could ruin a scientist's data collection. Oh, so there's so many. So now tremendous sensitivity is needed, because radio waves have notoriously low energy. And this is where I pull in my Carl Sagan quote from Cosmos.
So the snowflake.
And he was essentially accurate in 1980 when he said this, when he said the total amount of energy from outside the solar system ever received by all the radio telescopes on the planet Earth is less than the energy of a single snowflake striking the ground. So we're talking about amazingly weak energy, and these radio dishes are so big. They got to, you know, they're trying to get as much as they can, and it's not much, but they can, and they get amazing images. So what happens with these radio signals? Why is that so dreaded from nature or man-made? And that's because, and I saw actually what this looks like. It throws, this radio interference throws nasty, these vertical interference spikes all over your data. And if it gets bad enough, it's like, but you got to just throw it away. Like, I can't, this isn't going to.
Yeah, like
you
an Etch-A-Sketch gone wrong.
It's really bad. And that's why they picked that area in West Virginia. Because essentially, if you looked at the topography and the geography, this is like a bowl-shaped area surrounded by hills and mountains that essentially shield it. And it's also why Green Bank actually has a truck with antennas on it that I saw, that they drive around looking for excessive signals from microwaves, Wi-Fi routers, or even automatic doors that use microwave signals. So if they detect any of these overabundance of, you know, radio interference or microwaves, they will send a representative from the Green Bank. They will find you, and they will sit you down, and you won't believe this, they actually amicably work out a solution with you. And that's what they do. It's not a big deal. Like, for example, that automatic door that used microwaves to open up, they just basically paid for swapping out their microwave emitter to an infrared one. There, problem solved. So it's not like they can't really make you do a lot of, you know, really anything legally, but it's, I mean, they will, and they're really nice about it. They will work with you and fix the problem. But if you get close to the observatory, though, the closer you get, the more insistent they become, especially if you're within eyeshot of that radio antenna. No cameras allowed. Steve, when I walked in there, cameras are off for the tour. Absolutely off. There's no microwaves, no microwave ovens, that are like right on the campus there. They've got Faraday cages over a lot of stuff, because you need it. And then can you guess, here's a question for you. Can you guess why all the work vehicles that are on site are diesel? Everyone. They're all,
is it because of the starters? Because it's a heat starter instead of an electrical starter?
Well, the diesel engines don't have spark plugs. And those spark plugs,
that's
specifically,
what I just said.
But spark plugs was the key word. Like tailgating, we didn't say tailgating, you didn't say spark plug. That was the key word. Because
they use heat instead of electricity, instead of sparks, that's what I said.
Right. And it's really the diesels have compression ignition. Yeah. And they have glow plugs that heat the area. So the wires that are connected to the spark plugs are like antenna, and they create nasty radio interference spikes. Okay, so let's talk about the radio telescopes themselves. Yes, Evan?
I'm sorry, but before we get off that topic entirely, what about the airspace? Is there a restricted air traffic?
No, they don't have any control over what's flying overhead.
Okay.
So yeah, they don't. There's not much they can do about that.
All right.
So the radio telescopes themselves, there's four active ones that are at the observatory. There's a 12.2 meter or 40 foot radio dish. They got a 20 meter. They got a 43 meter. And then, of course, the jewel in the crown, the 100 meter Robert C. Byrd Green Bank Telescope. Now, the smaller ones, we drove by those. They're beautiful. They're really cool. It's just a little miniature, you know, kind of miniature. I guess it's all relative, but they're really cool. But when I walked up to that Green Bank telescope, it was, I would compare it to the time I saw a Saturn V. Or I walked onto the bridge of Kirk's Enterprise. Not exactly as awesome, but right kind of up there. It was an amazing experience. If you've never seen, you know, something this big, and it, I mean, we're talking 17 million pounds. And it's over, it's over 485 feet tall, 148 meters. This thing is monstrous. And with a maw that could swallow a dozen starships, it destroys planets, chops them into rubble. Oh, sorry. I was channeling Matt Decker from the Trek Doomsday Machine episode. Couldn't help but thinking about that. So, Kara, sorry, right? Kara.
We all
so
fall for that one.
I mean, what the hell?
What a great episode. And if you're going to watch, if you're going to watch that episode, the Doomsday episode, watch the one that was, that had the special effects redone because they're especially sweet. Okay. So I meant the collecting dish. The collecting dish. I said 100 meter. That's about 300 feet. 2 1/3 acres. You could fit a damn football field on this thing. It's so huge. It's mind-boggling. And it really was a sight to behold. If you're nearby there, definitely check it out. And pictures don't do it justice. It is the largest fully steerable radio telescope in existence, the premier telescope of its kind in the world. And that's why this thing operates pretty much 24/7, 362. And it's been operated by 900 scientists in the past 5 years. And each of those scientists only had a 25% chance of having their proposals accepted. Only 1 in 4, 75% of the people that apply to use that telescope don't get it. And I'm just so bummed I couldn't get a picture in front of it, or go inside of it. I couldn't go inside of it either. All right, enough of that. So let's look at this, the amazing scientific history, the scientific discovery. And it really made me feel like it was hallowed scientific ground. So many interesting discoveries. I'm not even going to cover, you know, a hundredth of them, but here are the ones that stood out for me. 1960, Project OSMA. That's a project that where astrophysicist Frank Drake was the first to use a radio telescope to search for extraterrestrial life at Green Bank. And he looked at Tau Ceti and Epsilon Eridani, two of my favorite star systems, star system names anyway. Does anyone know what OSMA means?
OSMA?
Isn't that a character from Star Wars?
No, that's from The Wizard of Oz. Frank Baum's Oz. The Queen of Oz was OSMA. So they kind of just took that name, and Baum said in his book, he described it as very far away, difficult to reach, and populated by strange and exotic beings. So they used Project OSMA, the name OSMA, which I thought was kind of interesting. Okay, and 1 year later, what did Drake do? He introduced at Green Bank the Drake equation, which of course estimated the number of transmitting civilizations in our galaxy, and is still just one of the more famous equations around. Okay, how about this one? 1967, the first discovery of flat galactic rotation curves. That is big because that was the first hints of dark matter. In 1967, because we use dark matter to explain those flat galactic rotation curves. Because otherwise, without the dark matter being there, then all the stars in the outskirts of the galaxy should fly out. It's just way too much. Okay. 1974. This is a big one. 1974, Sagittarius A star, the black hole, the supermassive black hole, the center of our galaxy was discovered at Green Bank. And in that case, they were using the four element radio dish interferometer system. 2008, first detection of prebiotic molecules in space. And I'll end with this one. 2014, Lanikea was discovered. This is now, if you look at where the Earth is, we live in our local group of galaxies, and then we're in the Virgo supercluster. And the Green Bank discovered that we are in an even larger supercluster called Lanikea. And so it was a major adjustment to the address of the Earth. So nowadays, the Green Bank is still doing great science. Like I said, that Green Bank telescope is busy every day of the year, except a few. And notably, which is funny because it kind of came back around, they're also working right now on the latest phase of a SETI project. It's called Breakthrough Listen. This is the most comprehensive search for alien technosignatures to date. Specifically, they're looking for radio signals from 1 million nearby stars and the centers of 100 galaxies. So, man, come on. It's just... Do I even need to say what would happen if they actually did find a verified techno signature?
Huge party?
Yeah. Well, oh boy. Drunk for a week.
Bob, okay, how would they verify? Because you would have to verify that signal. Would the Green Bank telescope also be responsible for doing the verification of it? Or is there something else somewhere else on the planet that can independently do that verification?
Sure. You would definitely want independent detection. That's one of the big things that you would do as quickly as you could. You want to have somebody else on the planet discovered. You can't have just one place detected. So they've got the Green Bank telescope detecting. They've got one in the Southern Hemisphere that's also looking. There's also a Chinese radio telescope that's also joining in on this. So they would try to, before we could, you'd have to rule out, the thing is, you have to rule out that it's coming from the Earth.
Yes.
That's the biggest thing. That's the biggest thing. If you could rule that out, then that will be something.
And contamination. We haven't reached that point.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And what I like is that they're releasing their data every 6 months. Bam, they do a dump every 6 months. And the Green Bank telescope was used recently, Steve, you like this one, to scan Oumuamua for signs of extraterrestrial intelligence. You know what they found? A rock. It's a rock. It's just a rock. That's it.
A rock.
Yes.
Cool.
And so they are working on one weird signal that they found that seems to have come from Proxima Centauri, the closest star to our sun, and it hasn't been fully ruled out yet. I'll say that. But a lot of the scientists think that, yeah, this is probably, Earth-based. It's some sort of contamination. But they haven't fully ruled it out. And just think of it. What are the odds? There's Earth. I mean, there's life on around Sol. And there's also life around the closest star. I mean, that would just be, the winning a lotto 20 times in a row. But, hey, I mean, that would be, a best-case scenario. And, hey, it happened on Babylon 5. So maybe it happened on the Earth. So guys, if you ever get down to West Virginia, check it out. It's a beautiful place, and seeing that Green Bank telescope was really awe-inspiring.
Cool. Thanks, Bob. Jay, it's Who's That Noisy Time.
All right, if you don't like loud or high-pitched noises, please lower your volume right now, and then we'll play the noisy. All right, guys, last week I played this noisy. Okay.
Just keeps going.
All right, guys. So what is this thing?
Mechanical, something that needs to be lubricated.
All right. Well, Dan H. writes in, I'm going to guess that this week's noisy is a Japanese Ryuteki. Please don't. Ryuteki flute. It's a flute. Playing some especially shrill notes. All right. That's... That sounds reasonable. It is not a flute, but I definitely can. I've made flutes make this noise, so I'm agreeing with you that it does sound like a bad played flute. Amanda Lay wrote in, "Hey Jay, I love this week's noisy because I'm a big fan of whales, and that sounds like a cetacean to me. But which one? So many choices. It doesn't sound ponderous and thoughtful enough to be a mysticete. So I'm thinking that it might be what was described by early sonar operators as the canary of the sea. So is this week's noisy a beluga? Best wishes, Amanda from Melbourne." No, it is not a whale, but that was one hell of a guess. Moeen has written in from Chicago and they say, "Hey Jay, it sounds to me like a rooster's singing noise in the morning. I hear some dogs barking in the background as they wake up by the noise." This is not a rooster, and I will tell you, one lives about 30 feet from where I sleep, my neighbor's yard, and if it made that noise, it would not make it to tomorrow. Because I could not hear that noise at 6:30 in the morning every morning. Some rando dude in Australia named Visto Tutti wrote in. I don't know who this guy is. "This call sounds to me like the curlew bird of Australia. Its mournful calls at night spawned many a legend. Some say the birds call in the soul of an Aboriginal princess who was unjustly murdered the night before her wedding by a jealous rival to her beloved. Her spirit still calls for her beloved to this day. All right, so let me just give you the answer here. John McKinnon wrote in, "Hi, Jay, I've been a listener for about 10 years now, and I rarely think I'm right when it comes to Who's That Noisy, but this week I really think I know it. This sounds just like the cry of a bull elk." It's an elk, guys.
Oh, man, that's horrifying.
Yeah, so let me explain to you. I'll play it again, but let me explain to you. Now, this noisy was sent in by a listener named Stephen Tuscan, as in Tuscan Raiders. Very cool name, Stephen. This is the call of an elk. They're calling these bugles and chuckles. And indeed, it is during something called a rut. So at its peak from mid-September to mid-October, the elk rut is a time when male elks or bulls vie for the hearts of their female counterparts known as cows. Their goal is to prove their prowess and win the loyalty of a harem of females. 8 to 9 year old bulls stand the greatest chance of mating. Guys, this is an elk. Watch your ears as you hear this. You can hear the overtones, right? So I'd like to say a ton of people got this one right. So good job, everyone who emailed in the correct answer. I was surprised to see that many people know exactly what this thing was. So I would say it's probably an unforgettable sound, right? It's pretty easy to remember once you hear it. Okay, I have a new noisy for you guys. This is a noisy sent in from someone with a very difficult name. Pi Froge. It's P-I. That's the first name. Last name, F-R-O-J-D. Froge, with two dots over the umlaut, right? Isn't that an umlaut over the O?
Yeah, umlaut.
Pi Froge. Okay. Very cool name, and here is the sound. All made by the same animal. If you think you know this week's noisy, or you heard something cool, because you must have, because you have ears, please email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org. All right, guys, we got Nexus coming up fast. We have David Copperfield and Bill Nye talking together as our keynote, and then we will very likely have Bill join us for one or two other things during the conference. You can go to necss.org to see more details about who's going to speak. We're adding people to the list as we go, and we're really ramping up a great conference this year, so please do join us. Also, if you like science fiction, go to alphaquadrantandthenumber6.com. We have science fiction reviews that Steve, Bob, and I do. We do a new one every week. We have a podcast. There's all the details is on the website. If you want to hear and learn more about science fiction, you got to go to AQ6.
Thanks, Jay. All right, we got a couple of emails here. The first one's a quick correction a few episodes ago during science or fiction. One of the items was about the largest known star in the universe, which I said was UY Scuti, and a few people emailed in to point me to the fact that that is now the second largest known star in the universe, and actually it may even have fallen way down the list. That the new king of stars in terms of size is Stevenson 218, 2,150 radii, which puts it right outside of the orbit of Saturn. So 2,150 times the size of the sun. 2,150 solar
That's
radii.
That's nuts, man.
It is nuts. Now, UY Scuti was found to be... So that's bigger than the previous estimated size of UY Scuti. But in addition, new measurements find that UY Scuti is actually a lot closer than we thought it was. So it's actually a lot smaller than we thought it was.
Okay.
So that's why it's kind of, it's actually not as big as Betelgeuse. So it's a big star. It's a big star. It's just not in the top tier anymore. Stevenson 218 is now the leader.
For now.
Mm. All right. The next email is actually a bunch of emails. We got a lot of questions, a lot of people asking us to do a deep dive on the research into gun regulations and their effect on deaths and injuries. So we're going to do it. Obviously, it's a huge topic. We're probably not going to be able to discuss everything in one go. I wanted to, give people some background on this question so they could at least think about it, research for themselves, and have a framework of what do we know about the effectiveness of gun regulations. So first, the complexities. And some people pointed out, and of course, a lot of the people who are pushing back against gun regulations, the anti-gun regulation people, will often make comments of, well, the science hasn't shown that gun regulations work or restricting gun ownership works. And they'll, or so they hasn't proven that it's to be, that it's effective. And of course, you can always, in any large set of research, you can always cherry pick what you want. Part of the problem here is that the research is very complicated for a number of reasons. One is you can't really make blanket statements about quote unquote gun regulations. You have to say what specific gun regulation are you talking about? Where was it? How was it executed? Further, what is the outcome that you're looking at? There's multiple outcomes. And if you're not thinking carefully about that outcome, then, you could easily obscure positive effects. So for example, you could talk about all gun deaths, all gun-related deaths, people who die because they were shot, right? But that includes suicides, homicides, and accidental shooting, and also mass shooting. It includes all of that. There's not going to really be one gun regulation that reduces all of those things, unless it's something draconian like nobody owns guns, right? But obviously, the kind of regulations that are on the table are not going to necessarily reduce all of those things at the same time.
But to be fair, I mean, and I know you use the word draconian, I'm not sure I would agree with that word, but to be fair, in countries where they did really, really restrict private citizen gun ownership, all of those things were significantly reduced.
Yes. Yeah. So I'm saying you have to get to the thing where you have significant limitations on the ability to own guns for all of those things to be reduced. But the thing is, you can't, for any one particular regulation, you know, you could, like if you're trying to be a regulation denialist, let's say, you could say, well, it didn't increase total gun deaths. Yeah, but it really wasn't designed to do that, right? Right. Some regulations are not designed to reduce all of those things. And we'll want to talk about just a few of some of the more commonly proposed regulations and see how that fits into the data. Also, we can't do perfectly controlled experiments, right? We're doing ecologically or epidemiological data. We're seeing what happened if you compare states with different regulations or countries with different regulations, or when regulations were tightened or loosened, what happened, right? So this is like ecological data. So it's always imperfect. It's never going to be like every possible confounding factor was perfectly controlled for. So we have to make inferences from lots of studies and look for the patterns, what seems to consistently happen.
But that's not uncommon in science.
No,
there are a lot
not.
Of things that we can't ethically do, like a randomized controlled trial for.
Oh, absolutely. So there is a lot of research, not as much as there should be, partly because for the last 20 years, there's been no federal funding of gun as a public safety or public health issue up until like 2019. And so it's just starting to ramp up again. There were, privately funded, state funded studies. So there was some research, and obviously in other countries as well. But there was a huge chilling effect on federally funded, gun related death research in the U.S., unfortunately, over the last 20 years. In any case, what does the research we have show? So again, we could spend hours talking about this, but let me go over some of the highlights. So there was a good review in 2016. Which just said, let's look at all the gun studies that we could find and see what that shows. This is published in 2016, and they looked at all studies published from 1950 to 2014. So that's a lot of different studies. So 130 different studies in 10 countries. And they found a number of things. First of all, overall, gun regulations do decrease gun-related deaths. If you look at all the data just like in general, but of course you have to dive a lot deeper to get to some of the details. So laws targeting multiple different firearm restrictions were the most associated with a reduction in firearm deaths. Laws restricting the purchase of, like background checks and access to firearms, such as safer storage laws, you know, were associated with lower rates of intimate partner homicides, unintentional deaths, and suicides.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
The evidence, if you look at the evidence as a whole, overall, gun regulations generally work. I mean, just as a sort of first approximation here. But of course, like a safer storage is not going to do much to necessarily reduce homicides, but it will reduce
accidents,
accidental death by a lot, right? And obviously, it will reduce guns flowing into the criminal market if they, you know, if you prevent them from getting
stolen.
Stolen. Whereas, like anything that which delays the ability to buy a gun has a significant reduction in suicides. Mm-hmm. And also, it does reduce homicides as well, because a lot of times those are impulsive acts.
Yeah.
And even just having a 3-day delay or whatever the delay that's happening for background checks, you know, prevents that from happening. The number one predictor, by the way, of suicide is having access to a gun.
Right.
That's like the
number one. I mean, as a clinician, when somebody talks to me about death and passive death wish and suicidal ideation, it's my duty to figure out, are they just ideating or do they have means? Do they have a plan?
Do they have means?
And if they have means and a plan, I am legally bound to do something about it.
Yeah.
Do you ask them out? Do you have to ask them outright, Kara, or do you?
I do, usually. But usually it's because I already have a relationship with them. So I'm really, you know, going there with them.
Okay.
Yeah, which makes it insane that some states try to illegalize physicians, like asking patients, do you have a gun in the
home? My gosh. Why?
Yeah, which is bananas, because then you're doubly responsible. Like, you can't ask, but then if they do something and they gave you any indication, like, we have terrace off rules in California. It's crazy. Like, we're responsible if somebody goes and hurts somebody else if we didn't warn them.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the proposals that are being thrown around now. So first of all, I want to talk a little bit about the AR-15, because that is often a style of weapon used in a lot of recent mass shootings, and so a lot of attention is drawn to it. So I did a lot of reading about it, actually. I learned quite a bit about it. So first of all, do you guys know what the AR stands for in AR-15?
The A was the original automatic manufacturer.
Rifle.
No.
It's
the name of the original manufacturer, ammo something.
Anterior retrodioid.
Yeah.
Armalite. So it's not assault rifle. It's not automatic
what
rifle.
What a coincidence.
Is the R rifle,
yes,
though?
Yes. R is rifle.
Okay. Armalite rifle.
It was made for the military. It was designed as a military weapon.
By the Armalite company. Right?
That might be a better term to use then, because I know there's a lot of political argument when people say things like assault rifle or, you know, whatever. But
this is a specific term. This is what I'm going to get to. So by describing this, you'll get a better idea about what, because the language in these regulations matters. And if you just say assault rifle or try to define it in a way that doesn't really make sense, I'll tell you why, like, the assault rifle ban had a very limited effect.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't sell it well, so they sold the patent for the design to the Colt company.
Mm-hmm.
And they based the M16 on the AR-15 mm-hmm. design, and that's a fully automatic military version of the gun. Yeah, that they very popular in Vietnam and later still used versions of it. But their patent expired in the 1970s, so since then anyone can produce a quote-unquote AR-15 style weapon. And so that's really what we're talking about. It's an AR-15 style weapon because the design is now off patent, and hundreds of companies produce it. And there are also hundreds of modifications possible for these weapons. In fact, if you talk to enthusiasts, people who own, use the gun, one of the key features is it's so modifiable. It's like it could adapt it to so many different specific uses. So one of the questions I had was, do people really use this weapon for hunting? And is it reasonable for people to use it for hunting, or to allow them to use it for hunting? Because there really isn't any other purpose. People say for self-defense, but what they're really talking about, and seriously, like if you really ask them, they're mainly talking about, when the government tyranny descends on us, we need a good firepower to fight back. You know, that's why really the extreme, you know, people who want these type of military style weapons. But there are a lot of hunters who generally like it and use it for hunting. And essentially they argue that it's very effective. Of course it's very effective. It's effective at killing stuff. There's no question about that. So what makes an assault rifle and assault rifle. Again, there's no one feature. It's a kind of a combination of features. It's kind of fuzzy and hard to define specifically. There's no one thing that's required. But it's the lethality. Overall, these are just these are features and modifications which increase the lethality. So one specific feature, for example, is that it has a pistol grip. So which gives you better control and handling. It also has little recoil, so you can fire. You can maintain your aim as you're firing. It has very rapid semi-automatic fire. Again, semi-automatic is one pull, one bullet, right? Fully automatic is you'll fire as long as you're holding the trigger, and manual, you have to push the bolt back and manually reload. So this is a semi-automatic. The hunter's like, yeah, I love it. I'm hunting coyotes. I could squeeze off a number of different rounds, maintaining my aim. It's got good range, hundreds of yards. So it's, for certain situations, it's a very effective killing machine. That's kind of the point. So you won't dispute the fact that it's a useful hunting tool in some scenarios, because it's a useful killing weapon in some scenarios. But some of those same features make it, unfortunately, a very deadly weapon. One thing that came up, a couple of people emailed us and said, because we had mentioned that it's a powerful rifle, it's not that powerful. It's like, okay, well, that's a relative term. So it is a powerful rifle. It's just not powerful relative to even more powerful hunting rifles. If you want to take down an elk, like the sound that we just heard, if you want to take down one of them, it's not a powerful rifle. You probably will wound the animal and not kill it outright. You need a more powerful rifle to take down big game. But you could actually swap out the chamber. And again, it's very modified for a larger caliber bullet. If you want to use it to take down bigger game, you could do that. But if you compare it to a handgun, it's way more powerful than a handgun. It has something like twice the muzzle velocity, which you have to square that in order to calculate the force. So it has four times the force on the body when the bullet hits. Than typically, and that's even at short range. At long range, pistols might be effective at 50 feet, whereas, an AR-15 could be effective at 200-300 feet in terms of being lethal. So it's much greater range, and it hits the body with so much force that this is going to be gruesome. People are sensitive, just be aware. But it blows a large hole in bodies, right? That's what it does. Mm.
And it's not even about its power. It's also about how many rounds before you reload.
Yeah, we're getting there. That's another feature. So it may not be great for if you're taking down a moose or an elk, but if you're shooting human-sized game, it's perfect, right? Yeah. You actually don't want it to be more powerful, because then you get more kickback and you can't fire as fast or as accurately. Accuracy. So it's in that sweet spot for killing a lot of people, right? That's exactly where the gun
is. That's why
is.
They choose it. Yeah, of course.
Yeah, and so all right, let's talk about... And, it's 45. You can squeeze off 45 rounds in a minute. It's a rapid-fire semi-automatic weapon. In fact, if you attach the bump stock to it, it basically turns it into an automatic rifle functionally, even though it's not technically an automatic rifle. Let's talk about the large magazine, right? So that's a magazine is where you put the bullets in. That's how many can you take. So another feature of so-called assault rifles are that they are designed to take a large-capacity magazine, more than 10 rounds, let's say. And the assault rifle ban that was 1994 to 2004 in the U.S. banned large capacity magazines, over 10. So that's one of the features. There's a lot of evidence that when there is a mass shooting, when large capacity magazines are involved, they dramatically increase the lethality of the mass shooting. More people are killed. More people are wounded, twice as many people, three times as many people. It's a significant increase. So there's evidence to show that large capacity magazines, it may not increase the number of mass shootings, but it increases the lethality of those mass shootings, which again gets to you have to be careful about what endpoint you are talking about. Of course, they're not going to increase the number of events but when they do occur, it does make them more deadly.
And they have large magazines. I think they're I was 30, just reading, 30 round is standard, but you can aftermarket them to 100 rounds.
You can get a drum for 100 rounds.
Yeah. Or Uzi.
Except, are Tommy guns automatic?
They were.
So the difference is you do have to squeeze the trigger in between
Unless you got a bump stock.
Unless you have a bump stock, you're right.
Basically, yes, you pushes
you can modify
it so that,
that thing into automatic status.
To function automatic. So, all right. So what gun regulations, if you look at all the evidence and just how these weapons work, et cetera, what regulations are likely to work and are politically plausible? We'll just say that for now, in that they won't.
You mean here in the United States?
Here in the United States. That's what we're talking about. The United States, the one country that has way out of proportion, you know, gun-related deaths compared to any other industrialized nation. Mm-hmm. So like one thing would definitely be limiting magazine capacity. Another would be limiting the ability to own the style of weapons that are highly lethal. And it may be, you know, you can call them assault rifles or military style rifles or whatever, but these are weapons that can have a high rate of fire with a deadly force. Well, the other thing about quote unquote, how powerful they are powerful enough that they can get through police officer body armor.
Oh.
That's powerful. And that has, you know, a lot of people have argued, including with the Uvalde event, that that has a huge effect on these mass shootings. Because now, like, the first police who to arrive on the scene may be outgunned and may be not protected by their own body armor. And so they're reluctant to confront the guy. In one of the most famous, you know, shootouts between police and criminals, the police officers literally went to a gun shop and bought more powerful weapons during the shootout in order to, you know, have parity with the bad guys.
Yeah, so right there, just regulate things that are more powerful than what the police already have.
Yeah, so
but
if,
of course,
yeah, so
then the argument would be, no, just give the police more powerful weapons.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. But the thing is, but if you limit it so that you can't own a rapidly firing semi-automatic rifle that has enough power to get through armor with high range and accuracy, all these things. Unfortunately, it's also all things that make it an effective hunting rifle. But the thing is, you don't need it for hunting. So you could say, all right, for most hunting situations, you can use manual reloading weapons or weapons that are that aren't designed to be quite so deadly. But if you're somebody who for some reason requires this kind of weapon, like, and people are good, we go up against these wild hogs where, like, they're dangerous and I need to be able to essentially kill a lot of them very quickly in order to be able to be safe. It's like, okay, if you're that person, then you just get a license. You know what I mean? Which is the other thing, is licensure is hugely effective. It's hugely effective because it delays access to the weapon.
Yeah.
It gives you time for an extensive background check, and you can tie other things to it like training, safety training, making sure they have safe storage, all of those things. So just requiring licensure could connect to a lot of things which have been proven to reduce, you know, either lethality or the number of homicides, suicides, etc. So that's another hugely, I think, effective possible regulation. And again, if you want to balance this out with the right to own firearms, you just say you can, you know, raise the age to 21. You could raise it to 25. You could require licenses for different types of guns. Not everyone needs to have immediate unfettered access to every type of weapon. That's already pretty much established in the law, like fully automatic weapons, for example, are banned. And so it's just you know, some common sense restrictions on the type of weapons and when people can get them, so that there's responsible legal ownership, but we keep these kinds of weapons out of the hands of the very few people who are likely to do horrible things with them. And again, these are really not scientifically controversial. Most people agree with these things, with these regulations, you know, more thorough background checks, you know, licensure, et cetera. And in terms of the research shows that as best as we can tell, a lot of these things are likely to work. Now, of course, bad regulations that are poorly executed don't work. The big problem with the assault, quote unquote, assault rifle ban from in 1994 was that it was really easy for gun manufacturers to get around it by simply changing a feature or two, but making the weapons were just as lethal they just, you couldn't attach a bayonet to it, and therefore it was no longer a quote-unquote assault rifle, for example. So
right.
you can't,
we're always going to see that kind of creative approach regulation, which is why we have to be iterative with this.
Totally. Or, you know, I wouldn't have a problem with just saying just like drugs have to get approved by the FDA before they go to the market, there needs to be a pre-market, at least categorization of weapons. This is a category one weapon. That's a category. We already have this. This is a category two weapon. This is a category three weapon. And each category has its own regulation in terms of age, licensure requirement, et cetera. It's like if you want to drive a commercial 18-wheeler, you need a different license than if you just want to drive a personal car or a
motorcycle,
et cetera.
And that's the thing. Everybody is used to and understands the licensing protocol for certain responsibilities in our country.
Right.
Everybody has to be licensed to drive a car. You have to pass a test. You have to be documented. You carry around a little plastic card that has your face on it. You're accountable. You know, it improves responsibility because cars are dangerous.
Right. Again, the final objection to all of these common sense things that either we are very confident will work or should work is, but then the government's going to come and take my guns.
Right,
and because as a prelude to
the slippery slope.
So that's the narrative that is really driving the refusal to adhere to any gun regulations is this notion that, you know, you need firepower equal to the government, and you don't want to be on file because then they'll know exactly who to go to take the guns away from. It's like they don't know. It's like in most 40% or something of homes have guns in them, so it's not a big deal just to go to every home and confiscate guns. If that were your goal, it's not like the fact that you have a license or it's registered makes you really more vulnerable. But that's the thing. They're just paranoid about the government knowing anything or restricting arms in any way.
And that's why the hunting conversation is almost a red herring.
Yeah.
Because that's not the argument that's being made here. Like, oh, but I need this to hunt. I mean, some people might say that
in a
Facebook argument.
Yeah.
But you're right. But ultimately, when it comes down to the most kind of, I guess, the opposite of draconian, like the most extreme resistance to gun control in our country, it has to do with a fundamentalist reading of the Second Amendment, and it has to do with a well-armed militia.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and the AR-15 style weapons are sold for self-defense as well, but that's like not really a good application of them. They're not good for self-defense.
Right.
But it's like, yeah, when the hordes of people are storming your home, that's when you need the AR-15. Yeah, like that's going to happen.
That's the view, offense and defense are
it's an apocalyptic.
It's an apocalyptic
scenario. That's really
scenario.
The only time. Exactly. Where
but that's
that would
why
come into play.
That's what people prep for. I mean, that's the fear based
weapons. That's right.
Rhetoric.
Yeah. But we have to decide as a society, is like having an optimal weapon to hunt any kind of animal you want to hunt, rather than having to make do with something that may be a little bit more challenging to hunt with. Is that really worth all of the mass shootings and
of course not.
Killed children? All right.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items, four facts, two real and one fake. And I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake. Three news items, no theme this week. You ready?
Mm-hmm.
All right, here we go. Item number one, a new study in yeast finds that about 75% of synonymous or silent genetic mutations are actually significantly harmful. Item number two, in a large Danish study, researchers found that having shingles increased the risk of being diagnosed with dementia over the next 21 years by 10%. And item number three, an analysis of air pollution in China finds a significant association with higher socioeconomic status and higher exposures to ambient air pollution. Jay, go first.
So the first one about the yeast, you know, 75% of silent genetic mutations are actually significantly harmful.
I'd be happy to explain that to you if you want.
Go ahead.
So a silent mutation is one where you change a base pair in the DNA, but it doesn't result in a change in the coded for amino acid, right? So remember, there's three letters in the genetic code, the Gattaca code, right? Three of those letters equal one specific amino acid, but every amino acid has like three or so codes that code for it. So you could have a mutation to another one of the codes that codes for the same amino acid. So it doesn't change the protein itself. That's why they're called silent, because they don't change the amino acid sequence.
Did that help, Jay?
Yeah, I mean, in a way, yes. Okay, so all right, there's number one. Second one, in a large Danish study, researchers found that having shingles increased the risk of being diagnosed with dementia over the next 21. Jesus, that sucks. By 10%. So there's a is there a connection between shingles and dementia? What? That is nutty. That is nutty. So shingles does something to you neurologically, I guess. All right. And the last one, an analysis of air pollution in China finds a significant association with higher socioeconomic status and higher exposures to ambient air pollution. So the more money they make, the more exposed they are to air pollution.
Yes.
Isn't that counterintuitive? Well, okay, let's talk about this. So if you're rich, you might live in a city, and the cities are pretty bad. But that's like really, really, you know, that's not like what I would consider to be ironclad freaking thought process there. But that is just wacky enough, and it's China, and I'm going to channel Perry and say, yep, because it's China, okay? I think that one is science. I think that the first one about the yeast – and the silent genetic mutations, I think that one is science. I think the Danish one, the study researchers found about shingles, I think that is the fake, because I don't think there's a connection between shingles and dementia.
Okay, Evan.
Okay, yeast. 75% of silent genetic mutations, actually significantly harmful. Wonder why yeast? Are yeast studies typical, and do they often do studies on yeast for looking at these kinds of genetic mutations? Interesting. I don't know. That one, I'm having the least amount of, you know, feelings about that one. The second one. Okay, researchers ate a large Danish. They got shingles. And, oh, no. In a large Danish study, researchers found that having shingles increased the risk of being diagnosed with dementia. Jay, you said shingles has nothing to do with dementia. I don't know. Over the next 21 years... 21 years, that seems like a long spread by 10%. How would they know that? That's interesting. And then the China one. Pollution in China, a significant association with higher socioeconomic status and higher exposures to ambient air pollution. Well, I suppose the reason being for that, the higher socioeconomic status means you're in the cities by nature. And yeah, China's notoriously famous for... air pollution issues in their cities. That seems to track. I guess I'll go with Jay about the Danish study and the shingles and the dementia. I just don't know about the 21 years by 10%. I don't know how they extract out 21 years.
Okay, Kara.
I mean, this one's killing me because they could all be one way or the other. 75% of silent genetic mutations in yeast being harmful. If that's true, this is a really big deal. Because I think the assumption here is that these are neutral, right? Mutations could neither be beneficial, harmful, or neutral to the organism. And I think the implication is that these silent mutations have always just been neutral or like net neutral. And if they're significantly harmful, I mean, it has massive implications, but it also has massive implications for our understanding of disease. So that's kind of cool. So there's a part of me that kind of hopes that's true, even though it's, I don't know, it could be a good or a bad thing. Having shingles increase the risk of being diagnosed with dementia over the next 21 years by 10%. This is a hard one because, A, I don't know anything about what is it, varicella? What's the chickenpox virus?
Herpes zoster.
Zoster. Yeah. And so they both happen when you get older. Like, are they related? I don't know. Why wouldn't they? I mean, viral infections often do affect us neurologically, but. I don't know. Is this just like a correlative thing? Like, it's just that people who, the older you get, the more likely you are to have dementia and the more likely you are to get shingles. I don't know. And then even though the China one does sound counterintuitive, Jay, I think you might've hit the nail on the head when you say higher SES and more exposure to air pollution, because even though income inequality in the US is really, really great, China has massive rural populations that are very impoverished, and then massive urban populations where there is a higher concentration of wealth. And so I could see that, yeah, it's just a function of being near industry And we kind of even think to like the Industrial Revolution in the in Europe or in America. Of course, if you were in the cities, your exposure was way higher. So that could be why there. So I think I'm going to go with the guys and say it's the shingles one, because I hope it's not true.
And Bob.
I agree with Jay. Shingles fiction.
All right.
Oh, boy.
Thanks for being succinct.
We're all together.
So there was actually a hidden theme in these items. These studies all showed, as written, the opposite of what the researchers thought they were going to show.
Oh, cool.
So we'll see which one. Does that help you or not help you? We'll see.
I mean, all right. That's probably why they all feel like they could go either way.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. They're all counterintuitive to the researchers themselves. So
surprise.
We'll take them in order. A new study in yeast finds that about 75% of synonymous or silent genetic mutations are actually significantly harmful. You all think this one is science. And this one is science.
Wow, that's a big deal.
That's a little scary,
that's
man.
A big deal. So, Evan, to answer your question, they use yeast because it reproduces very quickly. So if you're looking for something like mutations, you want a research creature that has a very, very fast generation time. So yeast is very easy to use that way. They can gather a lot of data. So, Carrie, you're correct. I mean, you had the appropriate reaction to this. We thought that silent mutations were silent, ergo neutral. And but we have been discovering recently, and this is why they looked at this, they wanted to see, is this really true and what's the extent of the phenomenon, that some mutations, some quote-unquote silent or synonymous mutations, are harmful because they affect the copy number, right? They affect the translation of the gene into protein, so how much of the protein gets made. Doesn't affect the sequence or the structure of the protein, but it affects how much gets made. And that could have a measurable effect, like an epigenetic, you know, phenomenon. But they were still shocked by the 75% number. That was the researchers were like, they had no idea the number was going to be that high or harmful. Like they were using essentially a Darwinian measure of beneficial or harmful. If it reduced the number of generations, reduced the number of offspring, that was harmful. If it increased it, that was beneficial. No significant change was neutral. They also found that 1.7% were beneficial, a tiny number, and the rest were neutral. But 75% being significantly, harmful was a shocker to the researchers.
Same protein.
Yeah, same protein, but they're just not making as much of it, right, is the idea. So the researchers, said appropriately, we have to make sure this replicates in other animals, in other creatures, but there's no reason a priori to think that yeast would be different. It's probably similar, but until we do those studies, we have to see how generalizable, that 75% is. Even if it's not generalizable specifically, this is fitting a trend in recent research that we're learning that silent mutations are not so silent. And Carrie, you're also correct in that immediately this has huge implications for genetic diseases, because we only look at the non-silent mutations. Like, we're not even looking, when we're looking for genetic diseases, we're not even looking for the silent mutations. So now we have to. And so this could lead to a whole, pulse of discovery of new genetic mutations, point mutations, that can be associated with disease states, so this is huge.
And can be treated.
All right, let's go on to number two. In a large Danish study, researchers found that having shingles increased the risk of being diagnosed with dementia over the next 20 years by 10%. You guys all think this one is the fiction. So the question is this the counterintuitive result, or would the opposite be the counterintuitive result? Well, this one is the fiction.
Guys. Nice job.
Yay. Cool.
The researchers were looking to see if shingles increased the incidence of dementia. And what they found is that it actually decreased it a little bit.
Cool. I had shingles. I'm psyched.
Yeah. I mean, and Evan, you asked, well, how did they do a 21-year follow-up? This was a retrospective study. They were looking at a large, and Danish is important here because the Danes have really good public health records. So it's one of the countries where you can do this. They looked at 247,000 people who visited the hospital with shingles and compared them to 1.2 million people who didn't. They age and sex sex matched to them. And then they looked at the subsequent 21 years to see if they were diagnosed with dementia. And the number was 9.7% in people who had shingles and 10.3% in people who did not. So there was a slight increase in people who did not have shingles. Whether that's a real effect or whatever, it's hard to say. It's not that big of an effect, but it was in the opposite direction than what they were looking for.
And that's if they actually had a shingles outbreak, not just that they had the virus.
Well, it was they were, the charts were identified because they were diagnosed with shingles or they were given antiviral medication for shingles.
Okay.
That's what, those were the two flags they used to identify those 247,000 people.
Right. Because I haven't had shingles. I don't think I'm quite at that age yet, but I definitely had chickenpox like most people my age.
Yeah, same here. Chickenpox, no shingles.
Chickenpox.
Got to get the vaccine. Get the vaccine.
Yeah, that's true. There is a vaccine for it. I don't think I'm eligible until I'm 50. Mm-hmm. I could be wrong, but yeah.
I can get it now. All right. This means that an analysis of air pollution in China finds a significant association with higher socioeconomic status and higher exposures to ambient air pollution. That is science. The researchers were expecting it to be the opposite because it's the opposite in pretty much every other country studied. So the question is, what's different about China? And so you guys mentioned that, yes, the poor people live in the country on farms. Mm-hmm. And if you're wealthy, you probably live in a city. But even within cities, think about this, even within cities, the wealthier people get higher exposure. So it's not just rural versus urban divide, although that is part of it. If people who have lived in cities for longer are ones that have the most health, and they are in the parts of cities that have more industry. And so it's just a unique pattern to China because of where they are in their industrialization and the pattern of industrialization and where the populations have moved to. It's just that for some reason, wealth has brought people in closer proximity to the sources of particulate matter, of specific kinds of pollution. And so it's producing this pattern, but it really is the opposite of what they were expecting and what has been shown in other industrialized nations around the world, including the United States. There's usually the poor people live next to the coal factories, right? That's the general pattern in the U.S., for example. So all counterintuitive findings, very interesting. But good job, everyone. You guys got the right answer.
Nice.
Ooh.
I think Yay. I swept you last week and you swept me this week.
Yeah.
All right.
So it balances out. All right.
Always does.
Evan, give us a quote.
This week's quote comes to us courtesy of a listener, Luis Reynoso, who's been a listener for a very long time of the SGU, I think since year one. Luis, you'll correct me if I'm wrong there. He suggested this quote. He heard it from, I'll tell you who it's from first, Michael Lewis. He's the author of Moneyball, The Big Short, The Blind Side. These are all excellent movies. I haven't read any of the books, but he's the author of all those books, and they're great movies. And if the movies are half as good as the books, then those are great books as well. He has a podcast called Against the Rules, and Luis heard this quote spoken by Michael Lewis on his podcast. What I love about experts, the best of them anyway, is that they get to their humility early. They have to. It's part of who they are. It's necessary for what they're doing. They set out to get to the bottom of something that has no bottom, and so they're reminded constantly of what they don't know. They move through the world focused not on what they know, but on what they might find out. Michael Lewis.
I like it.
Nice.
Mm-hmm. I like it too. Humility. Yes. Yep. We talk about humility all the time.
Yeah. Critical for skepticism.
Definitely.
Absolutely critical. And I agree. And Carl Sagan made this point as well. Like, you read Albert Einstein's, papers, and they're very modest in the conclusions that they're drawing.
Yeah.
And then if you read like a typical piece of pseudoscience, and it's the opposite of humility. It's like grandiose.
Right.
Like the claims new Bible that they're making, are go so far out of proportion to whatever justification or logic or evidence they're pointing to. And they're just so full of their own unique genius. I mean, we encounter this all the time. So absolutely, it's worth pointing out. The real scientists, the real scholars are often intellectually humble. They may not be personally humble, but, you know,
right.
they let's say they don't have egos, et cetera. But, you know, in the process of doing good science, a good dose of humility and self-skepticism is absolutely required. All right, guys. Thank you all for joining me this week.
Sure, man.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.